¿Estás pensando en tus vacaciones soñadas este verano temiendo el costo? Con iBora recibes reembolsos en todas tus compras. Así puedes tomar más tiempo creando recuerdos este verano y menos tiempo soñando hacerlos. Ahora mismo, iBora ofrece a nuestros oyentes $5 solo por probar iBora usando el código La Música cuando te registras. Simplemente ve a App Store o Google Play Store y descarga la aplicación gratuita de iBora para empezar a ganar reembolsos. Usa el código La Música. Eso es IBOTTA en Google Play o App Store y usa el código La Música.
This is a Fright Fest 2014 special of
It's the Gritflix.com podcast.
This is a Fright Fest 2014 special of
It's the Gritflix.com podcast.
Welcome to another Gritflix.com Fright Fest preview special. I'm Stuart Wright, and today I've got with me Till Kleinert. Hello, Till.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Have I got the pronunciation right on your name?
Yeah, it was quite okay. In German, we would say Till Kleinert.
Okay.
So it's very flat. It's the German way to say it, but Till Kleinert is also quite nice.
That's my Manchester accent, I guess. So what's the film we're talking about today?
Yeah, the film is Der Samurai, which I have been the writer and director and also editor on. Which we'll be screening on Sunday on Fright Fest.
Excellent, excellent. So give us a brief synopsis of what Der Samurai is about.
Okay, well, Der Samurai is a film that takes place in a small village in the East German countryside, close to the Polish border, very dense forests, and it's about a small-town policeman living there who is sort of infatuated with the rumor that a wolf is roaming the forest around the village and who's sort of trying to get a glimpse of the animal. And one night actually gets a glimpse of something else entirely, which is a strange young man roaming the forest wearing a woman's dress and sporting a katana, a samurai sword. And this guy apparently is up for good and trying to wreak havoc on the unsuspecting town. And the film, taking place during one night, is about our heroes' trials and tribulations, trying to stop this guy from doing whatever he is planning to do.
Okay, sounds interesting enough. And if 50-50 is equal parts scares to equal parts gore, what would be the balance in Der Samurai?
That's an interesting question, because there is gore in the film. I'm not even sure if there's actual scares. So I think it would tend more towards the gore, like maybe 30-70.
Okay.
But I don't want to raise false expectations, you know? So it's, but let's keep it at that. 30-70. Okay. Sounds about right.
Now, it's showing on Sunday the 24th of August, and the three slots it's got, for those people who are listening who've already bought their festival passes, is in the Arrow video screen, it's on at 8:30 p.m, and in the Film 4 screen, it's on at 11 p.m, and in the Horror Channel screen, which is the one I'll get to see it at, it's on at 6:20 p.m, and that's at the View Cinema, Leicester Square, London. Right, well, let's talk about your film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard from that brief synopsis to picture an obvious tale from there. So what compelled you to write that story?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. That's why, you know, there's always the danger of me not telling it right.
No. What I mean is it sounds unusual, not that it's not obvious. I don't mean that you said it wrong or I didn't understand.
I understand. I should hope that it's sort of unusual. I mean, I didn't set out to make a like very original or very unusual film, but I think as it is, I think I can say that much. It's a quite sort of personal thing to me, the whole story. I guess it makes sense that it feels a bit like one of a kind or unique. But I think you can trace back some sort of elements that are quite universal. Like there is a lot of fairy tale imagery going on and fairy tale motifs that sort of go through the whole film. Also motifs from like German romanticism, dark Gothic romanticism, stories of E.T.A. Hoffmann, something like that.
Yeah.
But you didn't even ask a question. I'm just starting to ramble on. Where were you actually going with that?
No. This is adding colour to the picture now for me.
Mm-hmm.
No. So what I'm saying is, so you've already started answering the question, but the main antagonist you described is a man in a dress with a samurai sword. What compels that idea?
If only I knew. I mean, it's this is an image that pretty much came like ready-made into my mind.
Yeah.
It's like when I was going on a train from the Baltic Sea back to Berlin, where I live, you pass through all these villages that are sort of huddled down by the trailbed and by the trackbed, and they look very smallish, like miniature towns almost, you know, huddled together as if, and it was at dusk, and they looked as if they were sort of huddling together to protect themselves, brace themselves against some sort of conceived threat coming from the forest surrounding them. And it was right there. It was like a picture in my mind, an image of those empty streets being roamed by this guy in a dress with a sword. And I think you can trace it back to all sorts of comic books I've read, video games I've played. But I think it's not as interesting to me to sort of trace back all the sort of influences that led there, but rather to ask myself question, okay, why is that particular guy there? What's he doing there? Who's he coming for? What's his agenda? And just going from that image to sort of start exploring like an archaeologist, so to speak, you know, and start digging and hopefully finding out what it all means and building a story around it.
So from a script point of view, was the ending of your story clear from the minute you started writing it, or was that something that developed?
Well, I mean, once I knew that it is about the confrontation of this intruder with a protagonist who is sort of representing law and order, it was clear that some sort of final confrontation was looming at the end of the story, but what the result of that confrontation would be and also what kind of shape that confrontation would take was not that clear from the get-go. It was more of an exploration how those two would get along to see where it would take them. And I think there are, I mean, I don't want to spoil too much, but there are some curious things happening between those two that might not necessarily happen in a chase movie where you have a cop chasing a bad guy. So I think we end in a very unique and peculiar way that describes pretty well the sort of bond or relationship that exists or has been formed between those two guys. But it wasn't clear from the get-go. It was something that came
about. So are you, I mean, from your point of view as a script writer, are you someone that, do you outline it? Are you burning the midnight oil? Are you up early in the morning? Do you start on the script page and just see where it goes?
I think I tend to avoid writing for a very long time.
Okay.
Because then at one point when I force myself to actually write, it all comes out pretty fast, if you know what I mean, because it has been, I have been pushing it around in my mind for a long time. And I usually start in prose, like around prose text. And I start at the beginning usually and just go through it. And if I feel like there's a roadblock, I don't know how to get from one point to the next, I will skip some parts and go to a scene that I have very much clear in my mind already and fill in the gaps afterwards. But everything in sort of prose. So I have a prose document that at the start, maybe the first outline is like 15 pages long. And then it grows as I detail things. And then at one point when it's like 30 pages or so, it's quite good to go to the first draft of an actual screenplay, which is then basically like reformatting, inserting dialogue and stuff, which is like more like an automatism at some point.
So it's like you're adapting your own short story.
In a way, yes. In a way, it is like that.
And though
I think when writing the prose, being a filmmaker, I've never considered myself an author of like written text. So I think it's always very clear that it's supposed to, I mean, I think it tends to be very visual and very much like a blueprint already to being shot at some point.
So it's definitely more like a treatment than it is.
Yes.
Absolute prose.
So I think maybe it's, you know, I don't talk too much with other people about their process. So I guess it's a very usual process, because if I would start with a first draft of a screenplay, I think I wouldn't dare to write anything down. I think sort of running pros of a treatment is a much easier way to get.
What were some of those sort of roadblocks in the storytelling? What was it difficult for you to resolve?
I tend to forget, you know.
Yeah.
It has been like more than 2 years. This phase, this stage of the process, and so I think everything tends to feel pretty rosy in retrospect, you know. I think there must have been some of those roadblocks, but I think one thing that you can still sort of sense in the film, which is still not necessarily a problem, but that has always been a challenge to the film, is that the protagonist, who is the policeman, isn't what you would call like the most proper policeman.
Yeah.
Or the most appropriate guy for the job, and he has there's a sort of passive quality to him. Yeah. Like he's very reactive, which is always difficult if you have him as a protagonist of a film, because we are sort of also through those sorts of screenwriting teaching books, you are sort of used to the notion of the hero always being very proactive, very in charge, you know. So it's quite a challenge to create a character that is very soft and very passive and very, very indecisive. Or do you say that? Indecisive? Is that a word?
Indecisive.
Yeah. Indecisive. So that's the pronunciation. Indecisive. And make him work as someone who is your eyes and ears, because the whole film is told from his perspective. Yeah. For the audience, and also someone you actually care for. So that was difficult in the writing stage, and it went through all the stages, also with the actor, of course, because an actor, it's easier for an actor to have a sort of a very straight agenda that he can follow.
Yeah.
As if he is sort of, if there's a confusion, which is very inherent in the character, it can become hard also for the actor. And yeah, that. So I think that was, although I don't have any idea anymore if I can name any specific like solutions we had to those.
I think that's an age-old problem for horror screenwriters.
Exactly. Because often in horror, especially in horror, you actually what you want to have is you want to have like a substitute for the audience who can sort of be their eyes and ears, and who can be basically that scared kid that
it's very voyeuristic.
But a scared kid is not necessarily a good protagonist in the classical sense, you know. And sort of balancing that out, that was a bit of a challenge, yeah.
So when you're moving forward with the script that you're looking to shoot,
mm-hmm.
what aspects of the script? I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of sort of a combination, I guess, of the financial cost of shooting a scene and the technical mm-hmm. aspects mm-hmm. of shooting a scene. Was there anything in there where you had to sort of tone it down, rewrite it, and that kind of thing as part of the pre-production phase?
No, I mean, I tend to write with, can we actually do this in mind? So it's very often, even during writing, I will not be able to rest until I have seen, for example, a particular location, so okay. that I know, okay, this actually exists. You know, like if I write down a certain setup of like houses being in a certain kind of order or you know suggesting a certain kind of image, I'd rather know that this exists somewhere, that we don't have to build like huge sets before I keep going on writing about it, you know. So I usually double check during the screenwriting process, like traveling, doing location scouting tours and stuff like that, and also trying to figure out if stuff can actually be done by, for example, talking to makeup artists, et cetera, so I think in the end there was nothing in there that had to be cut, because it wasn't. There was one thing we're talking about. There's pretty early on in the film, there's a train going through, like which is like, okay, so there's a track and the cop is chasing the antagonist, the samurai, yeah. and the samurai jumps over the tracks right before a train goes through, so that they are separated, which is because we are a very low budget film, very very low budget film. Mm. So this is a huge thing actually, because it's not necessarily something you want to do like digitally or something, and it can be dangerous as well. And so that was something where we felt it's not entirely necessary for the whole plot, so maybe we could cut it. even though I always liked the sort of force, like physical force, that comes into the film all of a sudden with an actual train going through the picture. And so we managed to do it. So even that, we somehow got to do. So I think we were able to make everything. Like with the effects, it's funny, because with the gore effects, I think they are very nice.
Okay.
But maybe they're not necessarily like that convincing. I think they have a quite surreal, grotesque quality to them, which again makes it a bit easier to pull it off with a low budget, for example. So I'm not saying we're not going for laughs or for like a cheap, trashy feeling with them. But I think they have a sort of heightened, fairy tale-ish quality to them that pretty much works in our favor when actually trying to do it practically. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm a writer myself, but I'm not a director.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously things like you're talking about would come back as notes, but obviously this is you wrestling with it in your head. You sort of the writer imagining one thing, and then the director shooting what's been imagined.
Yes.
How do you balance that kind of the practicalities of what can be shot with your imagination as a writer?
I don't feel like there's a censor, you know. It's very much it's to me when I finish the screenplay, when I finish the first draft or the second draft, basically what I've written down is something I feel safe in doing. It's not, you know, it's not like I'm looking at it and thinking, oh my God, what have I done? How am I going to pull that off? It's, you know, it's so within the process, I think then it takes some. Sometimes convincing maybe the other departments that it's actually manageable, you know, that's another thing. Like, for example, there's a final shot or semi-final shot in the film that is also like a special effect, you could say a special makeup effect that is very, it has been described as very symbolical and very like extravagant, and it is, I think. And our special effects guy, who is not a proper special effects guy to begin with, was very concerned that this might not be working, but I was very sure that it would. Just, you know, sometimes you just have to decide that this will work, and then you just have to sort of convince everybody else that they can do it, and I think it worked. So I don't feel like there has been that much of a struggle within me to balance those out, the doability of stuff and my imagination.
So is this going to be your? Are you coming? Are you going to be attending Fright Fest this year?
Yes, I will be there. I will be there for the whole time, actually.
Is this your first Fright Fest?
Yes, it is.
Brilliant. Well, I don't know what how much you're anticipating it, but it seems that the Fright Fest audience has got as much fame now as the films that get shown there.
Okay, so how is the Fright Fest audience?
They're a very knowing crowd. They're very supportive of their genre films. Last year, a British critic called Mark Kermode, I don't know if you know that name.
Yes, I know. He's a legend.
Yeah, well, he attended the latest in the kind of, when there was a latest version of the Chucky franchise, and he came to watch that as part of, you know, so he could review it. And his experience of sitting watching that with a Frightfest audience was to comment I think it was in the papers or on the radio, that as well, I don't know if you have this in Germany, but in Britain we have sort of mothers and baby screenings or pensioners screenings, that kind of thing. And he wanted to introduce a new horror fan-only screenings.
Okay.
Because, you know, a Child's Play film, you know, to someone who maybe isn't a horror fan, can seem a tad ridiculous.
Yes,
but if you buy into the ridiculousness of it, then you can still enjoy the movie, and that's what happens. That you can be in a room with a group of people who are enjoying a film for what it is, not for what it isn't.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way of putting it. And also speaking about the ridiculous, which is something I think also our film has its share of ridiculous moments, which I think need to be appreciated in order to, you know, there's the saying of. That in order to reach the sublime, you need to be willing to also let the ridiculous take place, you know.
So
they are sort of interconnected. The one serves as a gateway to the other, and I think we were definitely going for that. So I sympathize with Mark Kermode's notion.
Well, with that in mind, then what would what from what without giving too much away, maybe just drop some hints, sort mm-hmm. of thing. What can the Frightfest audience expect that you'd be excited to see their reaction to it?
Yeah, well, I always that's the very German thing about me. I'm not, you know, I'm always very trying to balance things out and to sort of keep expectations at a realistic at a realistic level. No, because I think it's not. I mean, it is a horror film or thriller in shape and in format and structure. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure if it's a film that actually is supposed to scare you. If you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I think in order to appreciate it, it's very good to know your genre and to know your horror films. But I think it's more. I want the film more to have a sort of. Exhilarating effect, you know, on the audience. It's something that you can be gleeful to watch, that you can sort of gleefully like a descent into madness or something, like a descent into a place where even the most ridiculous things are possible, or where some sort of liberation through annihilation is possible, if that makes sense, you know. So I'm looking more for a sort of transgressive effect than to actually scare the audience in a classical horror film mode. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. I mean, if you're setting up an antagonist who's a man in a dress with a samurai sword, you're already sort of, you're not playing by the normal rules, are you? So I think the idea of transgression as much as horror, and horror is a transgressive media anyway, isn't it?
I like to call it a horror film, but when we get to talk about my favorite British horror film, for example, I think you will realize that my perception of horror is very broad, you know. So I also love horror films that don't scare me a bit, but they have horrific subject matter, or that are transgressive, or whatever, you know. So it's a very open field. And sometimes, especially in Germany, you tend to meet a lot of people who have a very, very specific notion of what exactly a genre film has to be, and they are very obsessed with rules, with a certain set of rules, and that they are very, very closely. My words fail me. You know what I mean. My experience, that's the thing. My experience, I have been to British film festivals before. My experience with the British audience have always been fantastic, because I think this is an audience that by default is so cultured in those kinds of genres that they know their, Zwischentöne. That's a nice German word, but I don't have the subtleties.
We'll leave it there for the audience to find out what that means. But I think it's a positive thing. But if you look at what's in the Rediscovery screens this year, I mean, just as a kind of, I think that shows off the kind of the breadth of what you might expect from a British audience or a Frightfest audience at that to consume. Because you've got Nightmare on Elm Street, The Shining, and you've also got Necromantic. Showing,
yes, so I saw that. I was very, very, very happy when I saw that.
So I mean, Necromantic on the one hand is a very, very art house horror film, more art house than it is horror, as I remember. Obviously, Shining is a horror film made by someone who wasn't a horror film maker of any great notoriety at the time when he made it, and the film remains to this day to be a very divisive film amongst horror fans. There's some hate it and say it's not a horror film, and others say it's, you know, one of the greatest horror films ever made.
I think it's one of the scariest films I've seen. So
Me too. I don't get this idea that it's not a horror film. I really don't know what people are seeing when they say that. But look, let's just remind the audience when they can see your film. So The Samurai is showing on Sunday the 24th of August, and it's showing at the Arrow Video screen at 8:30 p.m. It's showing on the Film 4 screen at 11 p.m. And it's showing at the Horror Channel screen at 6:20 p.m. So there's plenty of chances for those that haven't bought festival passes to go and see it on a single view. Now
They should see it, yes. I can say that. I think it's a very fun film, and I think it's a very interesting film, and it's likely to, I don't know, to give you the urge to discuss it or even to ask me some questions, which I would be very, very happy to answer. So,
and are you, if you're saying you're going to be there, you're going to be there for a Q&A as well after the film?
Yeah, sure. I hope so. I mean, I hope people will have questions. I would love to answer them. Yeah.
And they're the best. They're the best horror films in my mind. The ones that raise questions.
Yeah.
Now you've already hinted at where this podcast may end. As it's Britflix, and Britflix allows me a bit more freedom during Fright Fest to cover non-British films because I'm covering a big British festival. But I always like to get the people on the podcast to recommend for me a British horror film. Now, obviously, you being a German writer-director, that would seem a bit unfair to sort of nail you down and say, you know, what? Usually I ask, you know, one that deserves a bit more kudos. Yeah. But I think what would be more interesting to understand is a British horror film that you like, that you don't think enough Germans would have got wind of and should really
yes,
watch.
Yes, exactly. Because for this is a film that has plenty of kudos in the UK, I think. Whenever I bring it up, people just love to talk about it. But in Germany, it's kind of not well known, and it's sort of, I think it's considered a bit too weird, maybe, to really cross over. And I think people know more of the infamous remake than they know about the original, which is, of course, The Wicker Man by Robin Hardy.
Okay.
As I said, it's quite obvious, actually, I think, for British. But for me, when I saw it and I hadn't heard, I saw it in my first year at film school, actually, and I hadn't heard about it before at all. And it was a revelation for me. And because this is a horror film that is a very weird film, you know.
Yes.
It's a musical, basically. You have all these very nice folk songs, and you have a bad guy, which is this whole village community, that isn't. I mean, there is a horrific act at the end, but in a way, you almost feel like you're in on the joke with them on Sergeant Howie, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some sort of weird shift of perspective going on all the time. And I just love that how that sort of counterculture sexual liberation sort of stuff is used as a boogeyman for this very uptight Puritan guy coming there trying to find the missing girl something I hope about that whole blend just sort of gave me a whole new perspective on what a horror film could be or what a film of that type of genre could be and could achieve. And I think that the genre films that are successful in... Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Did you hear that bing?
I
don't know what that was. Okay. The genre films that tend to be successful in Germany, I think, tend to be more of a very... like, of a more... classical of a more like my words fail me tend to be more normal, more of a usual kind, you know. So this sort of embracing of the weird mixtures of tones and of maybe even of genres is not so popular here, and I think it's something that I very much love. Like, for example, also it's not a British film, but in the late 90s when the films of Takashi Miike came to the German cinemas, like Audition or Dead or Alive, the way they took like a horror film in Audition or like a Yakuza flick in Dead or Alive and made it something completely else by transgressing the boundaries of the genres, that was very... also very eye-opening. And to me, The Wicker Man does something like that as well.
I think you would find... I mean, the idea that Audition is something that's embraced by everybody outside of genre fans, and I think it would be divisive even among genre fans, a film like Audition. I think it's ambitious, and I remember seeing it at, funny enough, at Fright Fest. God, when was that? When was that film? 2009, was it? Or is it
Audition?
Yeah, when's that?
No, it was 1999. It was 1999.
Oh, no, so I must have seen it in 2000. Goodness gracious, that time's flown. Yeah, so I must have seen it at Fright Fest in 2000, at the first, which will be the first Fright Fest as well, I guess. God, time has flown. well, look, I was thinking there when you were talking about Wicker Man. The other thing that always gets me about the Wicker Man is the horror of a true believer, and certainly the finale, realizing that God's not with you in that moment.
Yeah, sure, and that he's only the perfect sacrifice to begin with because he is such a perfect believer. Mm. You know that he has been tempted the whole time to sort of stray from his path, which would have saved his life. And I sort of love the irony about that, that him not being able to sort of let go of his strict beliefs that in the end don't help him in any way, get him to become this sort of sacrifice. It's a very, very nice, very layered film. I really love it.
Indeed. Well, look, I appreciate your time on the podcast, and I look forward to seeing The Samurai at Fright Fest, and hopefully I'll get a chance to say hello to yourself.
Yeah, would love to. Okay.
Indeed. Well, just one last thing. There's no official release date yet, but we reckon it's going to be in the autumn time sometime, don't we?
Yeah, so sometime in autumn, I think. It's going to be released by Peccadillo Pictures. Okay. And I think it's going to be a theatrical release, if I'm not mistaken, and sometime around October or something. But
and
they
can people
better
follow you or the film on Twitter or anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
Can what? People follow you or the movie on Twitter anyway?
I'm not so good with all the new media kind of stuff. I mean, there's a Facebook page called Der Samurai, which I've been told is very hard to find because there's so many samurai pages all over Facebook. But that's one you could like, and I try to update it every so often with some sort of info, reviews, tidbits. So that's something you could do.
Okay, well, I'll put a link in with the details that go alongside the podcast.
It's Der Samurai, D-E-R Samurai on Facebook. Hopefully you will find it.
I'm sure I will. Look, well, thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you. And looking forward to London.
This is a Fright Fest 2014 special of
It's the Britflix.com podcast.
This is a Fright Fest 2014 special of
It's the Britflix.com podcast.